This is a CBC podcast. If you just can't get enough CBC, make sure you check out our shop online. Discover music, books, clothing, and accessories at cbc.ca/shop.
Today on Power and Politics, how far will protesters go in Egypt? As a day of rage explodes in the street, could this destabilize the entire region? We'll ask the CBC's Neil MacDonald what this means for U.S.-Egypt relations. And we'll talk to former Canadian ambassador to Egypt, Michael Bell, about who could replace President Hosni Mubarak. And should the government pay you to get fit? We talked to author Neil Seaman, who says it should. But would healthy living vouchers be a good investment? We ask MPs Colin Carey, Keith Martin, and Megan Leslie. This is Power and Politics. Rosemary Barton, Evan is away tonight. You're looking right now at the scene in Cairo. It's midnight there and people are still on the street, ignoring a government-imposed curfew. Thousands of protesters clashed with police and the military in what they called a day of rage. They're demanding President Hosni Mubarak, who's led the country for 30 years, step aside. The CBC's Nahla Ayed is in Cairo and has more on what happened today.
The Friday of anger started like every Friday, a mid-morning gathering of the faithful. Then, wave after wave of anger rolled out across the country. Their defiance is unprecedented. Bold confrontations spoke loudly for a people who'd had enough. That defiance came in groups, big and small, taunting riot police with rocks and slogans, all along calling for President Hosni Mubarak to step down. There were also individual, fearless acts of showing total disregard for authority.
People here in Egypt, you need freedom, you know, freedom. This government, it's so bad.
At first, the main task for police was to contain the spread of protests in Egypt's cities and break up those that were gaining momentum. They used water cannons and tear gas, a lot of tear gas. As the day wore on, though, they'd have to resort to more.
The authorities are obviously taking this very, very seriously. There are thousands of riot police on streets all over this city. But the protesters say that their anger is no longer containable. They say, actually, that this is just a start.
Mubarak may be in their sights, but this is about so much more than his 30-year iron-fisted rule. Seething anger is also about political freedom, lack of jobs for youth, and the never-ending state of emergency that allows the state to arrest and imprison at will. As night fell, Mubarak ordered a nationwide curfew to stop the protests, but instead they only grew. Police vehicles were commandeered and destroyed, and even more symbolically, Mubarak's ruling National Democratic Party headquarters was consumed by fire. That's when the army was deployed in central Cairo. Gunfire could be heard, and so could helicopters. Several explosions sent smoke across the skyline. This day of anger may now be over, but the rage lingers, and it looks likely to bring yet more chaos. Nahla Ayed, CBC News, Cairo.
And today in Washington, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton urged restraint from the Egyptian government and called for economic, social, and political reforms in the country. Here's part of Clinton's remarks.
We support the universal human rights of the Egyptian people, including the right to freedom of expression, of association, and of assembly. We urge the Egyptian authorities to allow peaceful protests and to reverse the unprecedented steps it has taken to cut off communications.
Okay, so that's the official message out of the United States today, but there is a whole lot more going on behind closed doors. And joining me now for that story is CBC's senior Washington correspondent, Neil MacDonald. Neil, I can only imagine how tense it must be in Washington, because this is a very delicate balancing act that Washington is having to weigh in on.
Yeah, Rosemary, there's some very careful diplomatic tap dancing going on here. You heard Secretary Clinton talk about America's respect for the universality of free speech and association and assembly. Notice you didn't hear anything about democracy, free and fair elections, or regime change. The problem for Washington, as one analyst put it today, is that all the wrong Arabs are demonstrating. President Ben Ali of Tunisia was a reliable U.S. ally in what George Bush called his war on terror. Same goes for Hosni Mubarak. Mubarak has kept the Suez Canal safeguarded. He has maintained a cold but durable peace with Israel. He has crushed violent and nonviolent Islamists. He's a key ally of the United States. There have been other uprisings in the region, in Jordan and in Yemen. The Yemenis allow American Predator strikes against Al-Qaeda people there, and the Jordanians have virtually been an American proxy in the regions. You would think that, well, you have to know that the Americans would like to see this perhaps spread to Syria or some of the regimes that they would like to see changed.
Yeah.
How they go forward with this and what's coming next is a big worry.
Well, you mentioned that some Americans think the wrong Arabs are protesting. What do they mean by that? Is that they do want to see protests in other nations that are more problematic for them?
Well, you know, they don't want to see... Here's what happens when you call for when you get democracy in the Middle East. The last time the U.S. pushed for it, they wound up with Hamas governing Gaza. The Middle East is a special place. The Americans have deep and crucial security interests there, and they have traditionally valued stability over democracy and human rights. There is a huge transition going on here. There's a sea change going on, probably. No one knows where it's going, and the U.S. is scrambling to find the right place to be. There are no American flags. We haven't seen very many American flags being burned. That hasn't escaped Washington, but they also know that the faces of these dictators are also the faces of America, and they want to make sure going forward that they're on the right side of whatever powers do come to the fore.
Okay,
and that they can safeguard their strategic interests.
Thank you very much for your analysis tonight. That's Neil MacDonald, CBC's senior Washington correspondent. So how will the situation in Egypt affect political stability in the Middle East, and what impact could the departure of Hosni Mubarak have for the region? Joining me now is Canada's former ambassador to Egypt, Michael Bell, and he is also currently senior scholar on international diplomacy at the University of Windsor. Good to see you, Mr. Bell.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so you were in Egypt for about 4 years as ambassador. You have a sense of who Hosni Mubarak is. Can you tell us a little bit more about your understanding of him as a man?
Well, he's a military officer. He was an Air Force general. He comes from a long line of military officers that have ruled Egypt. We had Nasser and then Sadat and, and then Mubarak. So I think he's very much in that tradition, but he's been in power for a long time, over 30 years.
Yeah.
And he is an autocrat. There's no doubt about it. But I don't think a comparison with the former President Ben Ali in Tunisia that you could say he is corrupt, at least not on a scale that comes anywhere near some of his other rulers in the region. In the time I was there, I never heard a criticism of him or his wife for that kind of thing. He's obviously very used to power and enjoys exercising it. It's an autocracy, and one has to recognize that in these regimes, even though the Egyptians have traditionally said, well, we have our own kind of democracy and we have elections and what have you, this was a bit of a facade, in the sense that the results were always predetermined, and if things looked chancy, the regime just stepped in to ensure that the outcome satisfied them.
So would he go willingly? Would he give up power willingly, given the way you described him?
Power is sweet, and the more you have of it, the sweeter it gets. So no, he certainly wouldn't go willingly were he to feel that there was a chance to hold on. Now, his conception before these riots and demonstrations and what have you was, I think, very much that his son Gamal succeed him. Now, Gamal's a much younger man, a businessman, looks cool, progressive, what have you. And I think there would have been an effort to try to sell the son as something different, you know, more sophisticated, more aware of the needs of people, et cetera, both politically and economically. I don't think anything would have really changed. That looks increasingly problematic, though, given the situation.
Okay, so if it's not the son, who or what would fill the void in this stage?
Well, if the regime were to stay in power, the only other person I can see is the chief of security, Omar Suleiman. But that wouldn't go any way to meeting the requirements of the demonstrators and the opposition. So I really think that unless they can control things in the streets over the next few days, that the regime may well change.
Wow. how would this impact the region? Because, I mean, you mentioned Tunisia, but we're seeing these uprisings throughout the region. How would this impact the Middle East in a more general way if this were to happen?
Well, I think it certainly, just as events in Tunisia inspired the Egyptians and others, with this happening in Egypt, the most important Arab country right in the heartland of the Arab world, the results could be strategic analysts would say, destabilizing, mm-hmm. in that it would create a new environment. That could be good if there's a more progressive, democratically inclined government, reformist government that comes to power. But I think what we have to think about also is the Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian Islamists, who, while officially illegal, are in fact tolerated and cooperate with the Mubarak regime. Mm-hmm. So that they have their mosques, they have their educational institutions, hospitals, social welfare agencies, and they are the only group that has been allowed to get this grip on society except through government channels.
Yeah.
So they haven't intervened to this point that I know of, but they must be thinking about it. The reason I think they haven't intervened is if Mubarak were to come up on top, they wouldn't want to jeopardize the present situation. If it looks like he's losing, they'll want to be in the political process. And the closest parallel here is the 1979 revolution in Iran, which got rid of the Shah. The original opposition coalition that came to power was broad, from Marxist to Islamist. Mm. The Islamists, better organized, better able, managed to isolate the secular forces and establish its own autocracy. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Let me just quickly ask you about El Barada, who is apparently under house arrest possibly right now.
Yeah.
Would he be a possible next leader? Would he be the next response to fill in that spot?
He might well be.
Yeah.
But his problem is that he doesn't have deep roots in Egypt. I mean, he hasn't been there. He's been abroad. He's a symbol of hope, in fact, for many. Maybe on an interim basis, which he would hope to make more permanent, but I think there'd still be questions. You see in the interviews on Al Jazeera and what have, people say, we want to choose. We don't want anybody else to be imposed. Now, they may not have that luxury because there is an autocratic tradition that's very strong in Egypt, but I would think he may well be as the best-known figure, at least on the interim and possibly into the longer term, the best choice, put it that way.
Yeah.
Having said that, very concerned about the play of political forces in the country between secular and religious should the Mubarak regime go.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're quite welcome.
Well, the Canadian government estimates there are 6,500 Canadians in Egypt right now, and it just issued a travel warning on all non-essential travel to Cairo, Alexandria, and Suez. They're also warning those in Egypt to stay away from all demonstrations. The protests in Egypt also spilled over to Canada today. People gathered outside the Egyptian embassy in Montreal and Edmonton. Plus, another group gathered outside the Egyptian embassy here in Ottawa. Another rally is planned at Yonge and Dundas Square in Toronto tomorrow. Okay, now for our question of the day. Coming up, we're going to introduce you to a man with a maybe controversial idea that the government should provide $5,000 healthy living vouchers for people to improve their health and fitness and through fitness and other activities. So we want to ask you, should the government pay Canadians to get healthy? How would you like that? Vote and contact us at cbc.ca/politics, politics@cbc.ca. And you can, of course, reach me on Twitter @RosieBarton. We'll read your best comments live on the air with Zuleika Nathu a little bit later in the program. Stay with us. We'll have an interview with Neil Seaman, the author who's floated that controversial proposal. But will it work? We'll ask MPs Colin Carey, Keith Martin, and Megan Leslie if the government should subsidize people to get healthier. Stay with us. We're going to take you live to Cairo right now, where Hosni Mubarak is speaking. He had promised to speak all day. Let's listen in live.
To give them the space to tell what they want and what they need. After that,
I
After that, I was so sorry for what happened with the injured demonstrators and the officers. The government did what it was asked, and it was obvious. It was obvious that the armed forces worked with our youth and protected it and respected them to be peaceful in their demonstration under the law. And before it transferred into chaos and threatened the law and the life of every citizen. These demonstrations and what we saw before that in the years before, it shouldn't have happened due to the big gaps of freedom that were given. As a president of this country, and with all the Constitution, with all the power that the Constitution gave me, I assure you that he's working for, that I'm working for the people and giving freedoms of opinion as long as you're respecting the law. There's a very little line between freedom and chaos. I am absolutely on the side of the freedom of each citizen. And at the same time, I am on the side of the security of Egypt. And I would not let anything dangerous happen that would threaten the peace and the law and the future of the country. Egypt is the biggest region in its region, in its area. And it's under the law of its constitution. We have to be careful of anything that would allow chaos. No democracy would be there if we allow chaos. These demonstrations wanted to speak about their opinion, to give more job opportunities, and to lower the prices, and to fight the poor. I know all these things, these issues that the people are asking. I've never been separated from it, and I work for it every day. But what we are facing as a problem, and what we have as goals, terrorism is not going to allow it to happen. But communication and talking would allow it to happen, to be achieved. It's not going to be allowed that things are going to be robbed and stolen and fires are going to be. You won't shake my opinion that the economy needs to be fixed, the society needs to be fixed for a better Egyptian society and a democratic one to be open to the world. I will always be on the side of the poor. And I'm convinced that economy is not to be kept for only the economists. And I am with bettering the economy. Our program to fight and to open more job opportunities and health and education for youth and citizens is the best thing to protect Egypt, a nation for a civilized people. In these demonstrations, the chaos and the fires is a plan to actually wreck the security. Every Egyptian should care for the health of the country, not with causing fires or wrecking private and public businesses, but things will actually get to a solution in the future by communication and conversation for the country. Dear citizens, I don't talk to you today as a president, but as an Egyptian. I spent war and peace in this country. Very hard times. We overcame it. We were united as people. But when we knew our way and we set our goals, the road that we chose to fix is not to be ignored. New steps for more democracy, for more freedom for the citizens. Steps, new steps to make new job opportunities and raise the economy and develop and to stand by the poor and the people who have limited salaries. This is what's going to make our future. And we can't do that unless we are open and we are hardworking. We need to build on what we already have and to make a new future. What happened in the past few days put fear in everybody's hearts and the fear for the future and for additional chaos and wreckings. I take responsibility for the security of this country and the citizens. I will not let this happen. I will not let fear to live in the citizens or to let this tell us what's going to happen in the future. I ask the government to resign today, and I will tell the new government from tomorrow in very specific goals to work with the current situation. I will say again, I will not be easy to take any, to decide anything unless it's for the Egyptians. And I will protect Egypt.
التي أقسمت يمينا أمام الله والوطن بالمحافظة عليها.
I took oath to protect. God protect Egypt and everybody. God have mercy.
You were listening to Egyptian President Hussein Mubarak speaking for the first time since chaos erupted in the streets of Egypt. He has asked the government to resign. He has also asked for a new government to step in. He has said that he is on the side of both the citizens and of security. He acknowledged that there were problems within his country, but says he wants to press on for reforms, economic reforms that he recognizes that there are problems within the country, but he wants to continue doing that work, that he is on the side of the poor, that creating more jobs and more opportunities are his top priority, and that he wants a better Egyptian society, that he was speaking to Egyptians tonight, not just as their president, but also as an Egyptian who cares about the health of the country. So that's some breaking news, the first words from the president, Hussein Mubarak, since those riots took over the streets, since the Egyptians had that uprising. We'll, of course, have all the latest developments on this story as it unfolds. We'll take a short break. Then when we come back, a man with a controversial idea to get you healthy. Welcome back to Power and Politics. Do you think the government should pay Canadians, you, to get healthy? Author and University of Toronto health researcher Neil Seaman thinks it might help. He's suggesting the government give Canadians a $5,000 healthy living voucher to go towards things like yoga classes or cooking lessons, things that would help them live healthier lifestyles. With more than 17% of the population considered obese, is paying people to get healthy the answer to this problem? Joining me now from Toronto is the co-author of XXL, Obesity and the Limits of Shame, Neil Seaman. How are you, Mr. Seaman? Good to see you.
Thank you so much, Rosemary. I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, so where did this idea for a healthy living voucher come from? And explain to us briefly how it would work, too.
Well, briefly, it's expanded from the concept of educational vouchers, first started in the United States and with greatest applicability to the poor. The idea is quite simple, conditional upon the patient satisfying a number of accountabilities, like showing up in face-to-face settings with his or her primary care provider or in an online setting. It's a substantial sum of money, we estimate about 2 to 4% off a provincial or state budget, and that individual, that patient, working very closely with his or her primary care provider, can apply the voucher to a wide universe of new weight management and healthy living solutions. It's overseen by a self... I'm sorry?
So you're talking about $5,000. That's the amount that you've put out there.
We estimate that it would be about $5,000, yes, in the provincial context in Canada.
And people could use it to do what? For gyms, for nutrition, what kinds of things?
Indeed. What we want to do is bust open the marketplace to enable the free market to come in, a universe of vendors, whether it's a personal digital assistance for diabetes self-monitoring, whether it's Bikram yoga, whatever works for the particular individual, and that can only be decided by the individual. The science of obesity now says very clearly that obesity and weight management and healthy living is a highly individual challenge, and only the individual working with his or her primary health care provider can decide what will work or what may work for the individual.
Okay, there's already been some reaction to your idea. Let me show you a little bit of what the National Post columnist Barbara Kay wrote in response to your proposal, because it's sort of an interesting response. This is what she said. She said, a lump sum might kickstart a healthy lifestyle for some people, but it is far more likely to be spent frivolously by the weak-willed, a category that describes the majority of overweight people. Why must we bribe people to look after their own health anyway? So what do you think of that kind of response to the proposal? And do you have any evidence that paying people to stay healthy would actually work?
Well, this is actually far from bribery. Bribery is when you coerce someone and give them something that they don't want. In this case, a healthy living voucher, in fact, doesn't force anyone to lose weight. It encourages someone to essentially do what they want, which is to maintain a healthy lifestyle and feel free from obesity-related chronic illness. I would suggest that in the current context, we actually do have bribery. So we have essentially weight bias against the obese. It's quite considerable, on a par or exceeding racial discrimination. We have taxpayer dollars being spent on very expensive public health promotion activities, which really don't do anything. And so I would suggest that the journalist to whom you're referring simply doesn't understand what bribery is.
Okay, so how would it work, though? How would you make sure that people didn't defraud the system? Would they have to come in and be weighed? Would they have to get cholesterol tests? How would they be accountable?
Well, there's a suite of accountabilities that would come into play. The first, of course, is working with the primary care provider. So the primary care provider, who has an ethical obligation, would ensure that there would be accountability. There would be a self-governing regulatory body which would get rid of quackery. Quackery interventions. Of course, in any sort of initiative like this, it's new. It's a new model. So we'd encourage pilot projects to make sure that we can ensure that accountability is built into the system.
Okay, what about, though, the economic state right now? I mean, this is a country in billions of dollars of deficit. Does it make sense to spend thousands of dollars per family to try and motivate them to get healthy?
Yes, it does. Currently, obesity-related chronic illness costs Canada about $30 billion annually, $270 billion in the United States. So it's quite considerable. The knock-on effects on the healthy from those who are unhealthy are quite considerable. So the immediate return on investment may not be large, but the downstream return on investment is large. And I should also say that we spend about 5% of our current health spend, which is quite considerable, on health promotion, healthy living type activities, which essentially don't do anything in terms of significant return on investment. They affect people on the fringe, people who are inclined to keep well and live healthy anyway. But for those who are really struggling with their weight, or at some time struggle with their weight, which is the vast majority of us, we require individualized health plans.
But I guess my point is, wouldn't this just help the people, as you pointed out, that are already doing well, that are already going to the gym and going to the doctor and eating well? Would it really motivate the person who doesn't want to get off the couch and is not well informed about how to eat healthy?
Well, not at all. Actually, quite the opposite. And we take our evidence from, actually, we interview over 50,000, we have over 50,000 data points from around the world, and there's great receptivity, especially among the poor, to this idea. And again, we take our cues from the educational voucher context, again, with greatest uptake and greatest support among the poor. We also interview the poor. And in our book, we show quite clearly that the poor have great receptivity to the idea, and they will take advantage of it. The poor, we must understand, sort of have fewer options than the rich when it comes to healthy living, and they have every reason to take good care of themselves. It's really just a type of, I would suggest, stigmatization of the poor and the overweight to suggest that they wouldn't take advantage of this and only the healthy living will, healthy well would. So I would suggest that that's simply a misunderstanding of the evidence.
Sure, but everyone is receptive to the idea of being healthy. I mean, when I'm at the gym in the month of January, there's a lot more people there than there are by March. How do you translate being receptive to an idea to sticking with it and actually following through with it?
Well, again, it's about individuality. So what we understand about obesity is that it's highly, highly complex. And these top-down solutions, for example, you mentioned gym memberships. We couldn't possibly suggest that every individual be given $5,000 for a gym membership. That would be absurd. What we need to do is craft individualized health plans. We need to essentially bust up the public health architecture of how we deal with obesity and weight management in this country and around the world, and understand what the science of obesity tells us, which is individualization works.
So just so I'm clear, an obese person would get more money to help themselves get healthy than a healthy person who's already taking the personal motivation to keep themselves healthy on their own?
No. The definition of a voucher is that it is applied with universal applicability.
Yeah.
What we know about obesity is that it does affect all of us except for the super, super rich. And at one point or another, they would take advantage of it. So no, it would not be for just the obese. And we must understand that this is not about obesity per se, but it's about healthy living.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting idea and it's sure to get people talking. I appreciate your time today, Neil Seaman.
Thank you so much, Rosemary.
Well, we just heard there Neil Seaman's proposal for that healthy living voucher. But should the government consider paying for things like gym memberships to help Canadians lead healthier lives? MPs Colin Carey, Keith Martin and Megan Leslie are going to debate that next. Welcome back to Power and Politics. Would a $5,000 healthy living voucher make Canadians healthier? As we just heard from author and health researcher Neil Seaman, the voucher would be used to design and carry out a personal health plan, the aim to combat Canada's obesity crisis. But should the government be playing a more active role in keeping Canadians healthy? Joining me now is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Health Minister, Colin Carey. Liberal MP Keith Martin is in Victoria, and NDP health critic Megan Leslie is here in studio. Okay, so let's just talk about the idea that Neil Seaman had, that the proposal of these healthy living vouchers. Let's start with you, Colin, because you're with the government. What do you think of the idea of giving people money or vouchers to cash in and make themselves healthier?
Well, I think it's an interesting idea, but we'd have to see if a province brought this forward, how it would fit in with the Canada Health Act, because that's the law of the land. But Canadians have to start taking responsibility. It's a problem that obesity is a problem that we've recognized at the federal level. We put forth, of course, the Children's Fitness Tax Credit, which I think is a good move forward. We put all that money into the RINC program for infrastructure. But at the end of the day, it's important that each and every one of us gets up and does the physical activity that we need to do every day.
How about you, Megan?
First, I'll address the province's issue. I do think that this is something that would fall under federal public health. But if we look at the tax credits, right, so you join, you enroll your kids in something, you get a tax credit for skating, you got to have the money to begin with.
Right.
And so I think this is a really interesting and innovative model where we're looking at not just skating, not just the gym membership, but maybe it's about nutrition. Maybe it's about some other form of coaching or guidance. So the phrase in the article that I thought was really interesting, it was paternalistic libertarianism, which I don't know if that appeals to everybody or alienates everybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was, I think it's a really interesting mix, and it acknowledges the fact that some people actually just can't afford to enroll their kids in sports or to start getting healthy, can't afford milk and they buy pop, right? So we need to actually look at this a little more holistically, and that's why I think it's an interesting proposal.
Keith, what do you think from a liberal and medical perspective? What do you think of the idea?
Well, I think Mr. Seaman is this is a well-meaning but deeply misguided approach to a serious problem in our country. If you look at the work of Dr. Tremblay's report just released, the average child in Canada spends a colossal 36 hours a week in front of a television or a video game. This is the first generation of children who are going to have a shorter lifespan than their parents. But you can't incentivize what Mr. Seaman's proposing, $5,000 voucher, not to mention the administrative overlay that he's suggesting with doctors. So it's going to cost a lot more. Really what you have to do, kids need free play. They need to get out. When was the last time you saw kids playing ball hockey or soccer or pickup? Kids have to get out, engage in free play. They need 60 to 90 minutes of vigorous activity per day. And it really falls on the parents to get the kids out of the door, get them to go out and play. And this has to start early on, both on the activity side, but also so they know what proper nutrition is.
But Keith, what about some of the things that Megan Leslie's talking about? And I think that is the concern. Families who can't make, enrolling in teams and gyms a priority financially. So they need to have access to some sort of money because they can't make that one of their priorities in their budget.
Well, a lot of kids need free play. It costs nothing for children to go out and kick a soccer ball around. It takes nothing for kids to run around. But it does take parental guidance to kick them out in front of the off the video screen. And the facts are is that they are spending 6 hours a day in front of a television set or a video screen. It's inactivity and poor diet that works. And certainly there are populations in Canada, particularly in the north amongst First Nations, where food security and cost of food is a very serious problem. But for the most part, get the kids out, kick them out the door, get them out and play. And in that way, that'll not only be important for them physically, but it's important for them psychologically to learn the socialization and interrelationships that they have to learn early on.
That sounds easy, but if you're a parent and you're not physically fit or physically motivated, I'm not sure how you would kick your kid out the door and say, go play outside, don't worry about the internet. Do governments need to get more involved?
Well, I think it is important that everybody's involved.
Yeah.
The Minister of Health, you probably realized this past September, got together with the provincial ministers, and we put together a framework to help curb childhood obesity. But as Keith was saying, it is a very complicated issue. It's not just about physical activity. It's about diet. It's about nutrition. So that's why we've taken the leadership. I mentioned the children's fitness health tax benefit.
Yeah, that's
and
great.
Things
but
like
why
that.
Not extend but, that to adults then? If that's, you know, it's been successful and certainly helped out people who have financial issues, why not extend it to adults so they can, you know, write off their gym membership?
Well, you know what? It's a great idea for everyone, but you have to look at the cost benefit to all the things that you put into your budgets, and we're coming up with a new budget, so maybe you could make that as a submission. But
Here I am making it right now. What do you think?
Fantastic. You know what? And there's a lot of people that don't want to pay for other people's fitness memberships, and as you know, this is January. We're making our New Year's resolutions. Mm-hmm. How many people go to the gym, start the gym, and don't turn it into a lifelong thing? So obesity is a complicated thing. We are taking a leadership role. Keith mentioned the diabetes issues. We've got a Canadian diabetes strategy now, different initiatives in First Nations, partnering with NGOs like Participaction. But it takes everyone to get involved, not only the parents, but the teachers and their friends. Get them out the door.
As we were talking about during the break when we were just chatting informally, do you want to pay for someone's gym membership or nutrition counseling, or do you want to pay for their bypass? Mm-hmm. Do you want to pay for their stomach bypass? Do you want to pay for all of the things that come at the end? And I think about this model. It's interesting. It's innovative. It's a little bit different. I grew up always learning about the Canada Food Guide, and I knew 5 servings of grain, 3 servings of protein, etc. But I actually never knew what that was until last year. I have a subscription to Nutrition Action, this little magazine about nutrition, and it showed me a picture of what your plate should look like.
Yeah.
I was 36 years old and went, oh my God, really? Yeah. That's what my plate is supposed to look like? So there's a lot of education that can be done. This kind of idea, like he said, it's not just the gym. Maybe it's a nutritionist. Mm-hmm.
And Keith,
but the parents have to be brought in also. This is a really important point that you mentioned, is that obesity is not only amongst children, it is amongst adults. Colin and Megan, you've all mentioned this. But we know also that healthy children, healthy parents actually generally have healthy kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's right.
They're leading active lives. So it is an integrated approach, as you all mentioned. How about making sure that kids in school have mandatory physical activity every single day? How about bringing in the parents into the schools to learn about the importance of nutrition, physical activity, literacy? These are the building blocks of an individual's psychology and lifestyle that will pay off in spades later on. But you can do it for a very low price. Mr. Seaman's cost is looking at 2 to 4% of provincial budgets. These days, at a time of fiscal austerity, and deficits, there's no way any province can do this.
Pay now or pay later.
Well, this is really an idea, though, I think, for people of an older age, from 16 and older, at a time when you're not in high school, you don't have recess, you don't have intramural sports. You either have to learn to be fit and pay for it on your own, or you don't, and then you become a cost to society. So what about that, Colin Carey? What about the idea of the federal government being more involved in preventative measures? You know, if you put in $5,000 now, maybe you save $25,000 later.
Well, Keith was saying, it's not necessarily about money. If you're looking at the physical activity part of it, just getting out every day and taking a walk, walking your dog, getting people outside again. It's one of those things that kids come home, they're bused to school, they come home and they play their video games. It's a rut that people get themselves in.
But there's no motivation there. If you said to me, I'm going to give you $5,000 for you and your family, I might be way more motivated to get off the couch than just on my own.
But that's not what
happens,
though.
Go ahead, Keith.
That's not what happens. You can't actually pay people to do this. This will work, interestingly enough, for people who are already motivated. They'll love this.
Yeah.
But it's for the people who aren't motivated, which is the ones we really want to catch, who aren't going to be motivated by this. But there's two things you can really do. One is, as has been mentioned, if you catch the kids early on, the Early Learning Head Start program, the kind of work that's been done by Dr. Tremblay in Montreal, Dr. Hertzman here in British Columbia, shows very clearly huge cost savings for early investment, for knowledge, for both parents and kids. The second thing that can be done is the simple stuff is encourage the parents with the kids, and you can do this for 1 hour a week in school. Teach them what proper nutrition is what Megan said. Mm-hmm. Teach them about the physical activity, is what Colin said. And then it's just a matter of parental will, and you can't legislate that. You can't pay for that. It's about parents taking on the parenting role to actually get the kids outside and do the things like the ball hockey, which we played endlessly. When was the last time you saw a pickup game of ball
hockey?
Well,
Megan was just playing hockey, yeah. She said.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have the stitches to prove it.
She's motivated, you can tell.
Okay, I got to wrap things up, but I will look for this in the budget because you've told me now. Who knows?
Who knows?
Who knows? We've put
Excellent.
It out there.
What a scoop.
Thank you all very much for coming
Thank
in.
You.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on PNP, Zuleka Nathu is here with the latest in Egypt, and Stats Canada has revised its numbers on how many jobs have been recovered since the recession. We'll go on the money and show you those new figures right after the break. Stay there. Welcome back. New numbers from Statistics Canada suggest the post-recession job recovery isn't as rosy as first thought. What's the reality of job creation in Canada? Let's go on the money to sort it all out. Today's revision shows we shed 428,000 jobs from the fall of 2008 to the summer of 2009. That's actually 11,000 more than recorded at the time. StatsCan had previously reported that all of those lost jobs had been gained back and then some. But a new review of the population and labor force data has revealed that only 398,000 of those lost jobs have been recovered. So there are still 30,000 fewer Canadians employed now than there were 2.5 years ago. Finance Minister Jim Flaherty said today the Stats Canada revision is routine. In a press release, he said this: the estimates for the performance of the Canadian economy have not changed. The Canadian economy has created 400,000 jobs since July 2009, the strongest job growth in the G7, and the economy has grown for 5 straight quarters. Okay, time now to check in with Zuleka Nathu for the latest news. Oh. Of course, she is following the latest developments in Egypt, I'm sure, and we'll get to our watchdogs in just a minute. But first, the news, Zuleka.
Yes, well, I'm not sure. We wanted to show you live pictures that we have coming out of Egypt right now. It is early morning there, and we have reports that the army there is taking control of a central meeting place in Cairo called Tahrir Square. Witnesses say that protesters are running away to side streets to avoid them, but it certainly is a lot calmer than just hours ago. Protesters have openly defied a government-imposed curfew. President Hosni Mubarak also just addressed his nation, and he says that he's asking his government to resign. It was his first time on television since massive protests erupted in Egypt 4 days ago. Mubarak said he wants a new cabinet to have a clear mandate to fix the current state. He says he will push ahead with economic, political, and social reforms, and that includes job opportunities, the high cost of living as well. Still, he defended the actions of police and the military in quelling the demonstrations on the streets. Protesters have been fighting officers with stones, firebombs, even reportedly burning down Mubarak's party headquarters. Today, Mubarak also said that anti-government protests are part of a plot to destabilize the peaceful country, and violence, including the fires that have been set to property and vehicles, is not the answer. He added that things will only get done by communication between the people and the state, but democracy cannot happen through chaos. And Rosemary, this is all bearing in mind that there have been major disruptions with the internet and mobile phone lines in Egypt as the government has been trying to crack down on protesters and them organizing themselves as well.
And I'm not sure if you order a new government, but then you yourself stick around. I'm not sure how that's going to play out on the streets, given that some of the might be the president himself. Okay, let's switch gears a bit. Lots of feedback on our question of the day, no doubt about it, because the question is, should the government pay Canadians to get healthy? Guess who's on it? Those pesky watchdogs. Okay, Zuleka, what are you hearing about this?
I have a viewer comment here that says this: it would be ridiculous to pay someone for something that they should be responsible enough on their own. What sort of society are we living in? Doesn't anyone want to be responsible anymore? That comes from Rob 5225. What are you hearing over there, Rosemary?
Well, as I dumped my glass of water all over my papers, which I didn't have to admit, but I did anyway, here's one of the things I'm hearing, Zuleika. It probably would cost more to help people stay healthy than treating them for health problems in the long run. No pun intended. That's from Broker. This is a good one because... Do you want to pay other people to go to the gym? That's essentially what we're asking. Do you want your taxpayers' dollars to encourage people to go to the gym? It's a good one. So we're going to keep monitoring those comments.
Yeah.
You can send them to us at cbc.ca/politics, politics@cbc.ca, and on Twitter at Rosie Barton. Zuleika, we have to get you on Twitter. Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter.
Oh, well,
of course I am.
We should add your name, too. Okay, we'll talk to you again next hour.
I'll pass it on to you.
Okay, thanks, Zuleika. Okay, so remember those yes, yes, yes conservative attack ads that they were released yesterday? They are now gone, gone, gone. The Tories pulled the controversial attack ad today, and they're now insisting it's because it was a one-day online wonder. But isn't it an admission that the ad went too far after receiving a fair share of criticism after its release? Let's see how the power panel reads this one today. Kathleen Petty, host of CBC Radio's The House, of course, Rob Russo, bureau chief for the Canadian Press, and Greg Weston of CBC News. I'm glad I didn't dump any water your way. That was a close one. Happens at least once a month. Okay, what do you make of this? It's a very strange thing. Is it that they were never intending on putting them on television, or is it that they got a lot of backlash and thought, we better back away?
Greg, I'm told they were never going to put them up. One of the things that's happening with these attack ads is they get what's called in the business earned media, which is free advertising.
Meaning us.
Mm-hmm. And the more controversial they are, the more we go out and give them free airtime. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to buy anything. They mm-hmm. don't have to do anything. In this case, it was so outrageous that it, of course, became controversial in itself. And I think in this case, what the conservatives were hoping was those clips, as phony and false as they were, someone would copy them onto YouTube and they would go viral. Instead, they went toxic and kind of backfired on them. Lots of protests. I mean, it's so far over the top, it's irresponsible. No reasonable government should be engaging in that sort of thing. And they'll say, oh, it's the party. That's the government, and that's way, way over the top.
Kathleen?
Yeah. Look, if they thought these ads were effective, whether they created them for a television buy or not, if they were effective and they worked, they wouldn't be gone. You don't pull good ads. And if they work and make your point and you're not suffering as a result of it for all the reasons that Greg just mentioned, they still be there. So it's really hard to take that explanation without a heavy dose of salt from my vantage point. They may never have meant for them to be on TV, but if they thought that they were working and they weren't being hurt by it, they'd still be there.
Yeah, why not leave them on the website?
Yeah,
it doesn't cost you anything. And for that matter, the other ads of the Prime Minister working alone in his office, those ones are gone too.
Right.
So if you thought they were so great, why not just leave them there?
Sure, and if they were so inconsequential, this is a party that has a whole raft of ads already cut in the vault, ready to go. They went to some effort to cut this ad.
Yeah.
This happened a couple of days ago, and then bang, out comes this ad. So they actually extended some effort. I mean, it shows you that a lot of the waxy old nostrums of politics that we, you know, me too, I'll peddle them over and over again, attack ads work. Well, you know what? They don't sometimes. This is one of those rare instances where they didn't work. It's happened in 93 with the Cretan ad that made fun of his facial paralysis.
Yeah.
It happened with Paul Martin's gang when they tried to tell you that Stephen Harper would have barracks at the corner
soldiers
of Sparks
on the
and O'Connor.
Soldiers on the street.
That's right.
Guns, yeah.
They don't always work. This one didn't work. They work because there's a kernel of truth in a lot of attack ads that they build politics around.
Do you remember the Reform Party ad about leaders from Quebec? That was another one.
That's right.
Right, huge backlash to that, where essentially it was, you know, it came across as being, you know, for lack of a better phrase, I don't know if racist is exactly the right description for it, but something akin to that. Mm-hmm. In other words, we've had enough francophones in the PMO, and the Reform Party had to pull that.
Sure.
But do they learn anything from it, I guess, it would be the next question. Do they learn a lesson from it?
I'm told that they now realize, just as the Conservatives made a fatal error in 2004 with a statement saying that Paul Martin was in favor of pedophiles, they learned that you need adult supervision at certain points. This is one of those points now where they learn that they need to have a governor making sure that there is someone watching over these ads before they go out, just as they made the mistake with the DI ad, the sort of the puff and poop
ad. The puff and poop, which lasted longer than this one.
This is the old maxim, never let the truth get in the way of a good smear in an attack ad. And, you know, it's those ones that do backfire. And they backfire not because it gets liberals upset or it gets NDP supporters upset. It backfires because it gets conservatives upset. Mm. They're dishonest. They're embarrassing.
Yeah, because no one seemed to have a problem with the other attack ads.
No.
There wasn't this sort of outcry.
Well, yeah, you have to live with them.
Yeah.
These ones were just dishonest, and they were embarrassing. And a lot of people that I spoke to today said, we're really embarrassed. And so I think that's why they're gone.
Do you think that, I only have a couple of minutes, but a minute really, do you think it matters at all that the Prime Minister wasn't in the country? Do you think that there was any, maybe he didn't see them, he didn't know what was going on? Is there any of that going on, do you think?
I'm not sure that he would be in the position to be approving these ads. Actually, he's a campaigner now and they have the campaign. They're pretty separate sort of machinery. And I remember Doug Finlay apparently quite insisting, you look after getting out there and campaigning, and I look after the campaign, this part of it. So I don't think that there's any connection that way.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We've got lots more to talk about. We'll have the power panel coming up, and we're going to have Point of Order. The Point of Order boys. Here they come.
Coming up on Point of Order, I'll explain to Scott the backroom considerations that are driving the decision on whether or not to have an election.
And when Jamie asked me if the new Conservative ads hit an all-time low for being untruthful and unethical, I'll say, yes, yes, yes! We'll see you soon, Rosie.
We will reject a bad budget if that's what we receive from this government. We'll fight an election over it if we have to. But until then, I think we have a job to do, and that is to get results for Canadians.
That's Jack Layton telling his caucus the NDP won't back a bad budget. That's hard to say. But, oh, another one. There's always a but, isn't there? The power panel's back. Rob Russo, Kathleen Petty, and Greg Weston are here. I wish I understood what that meant, because it would make my life for the rest, these weeks going forward, so much easier. It was purposely cryptic, I thought.
I mean, if you look, if you're a political decoder and you're sort of plugging in your political decoders into what he's saying, he's assiduously pitching woo, and the object of his affection is remaining elusive.
That's good. Someone write that down fast.
He keeps saying, "I'm prepared to meet," and his line in the sand keeps getting blurred and redrawn. It's become kind of like a line in the water now, it kind of ebbing and flowing with the current.
And it's a mirage in the desert.
It could be.
Right poetic today.
I think it's clear that the NDP would rather avoid an election if they had their druthers. And I think it's clear if the Prime Minister wants to avoid an election, he could avoid an election at not too high a cost to him, either fiscally or politically. The question remains, does the Prime Minister want to avoid an election?
Well, and does Jack
answer that?
do the NDP want to avoid an election? I mean, let's just sort of fast forward here. We come up and it's another nothing budget like last year. Remember last year the budget came down a Tuesday. It was gone by 10 o'clock Wednesday morning.
That's right.
So we have another nothing standstill budget. Lots of rhetoric, not much action. Whether the Prime Minister wants an election or doesn't want an election, it comes down to Jack and the NDP. They're not looking at the numbers in the budget at that point. They're looking at the numbers in their polls. And if they're down at 12 or 13% in the polls and they're about to get trounced in an election campaign, it's going to be a bad budget. You want to know what a bad budget is? A bad budget is what Jack, if Jack needs it to be a bad budget.
But you still have to find a reason.
But
for
isn't it
to be
about
a bad
Jack?
Budget.
It's easy to find something bad in a budget. That's pretty easy. You can find something bad in a budget by virtue of what's not there, as opposed to what is there, which is what Thomas Mulcair seems to be talking about. Not what is there, but what won't be there, which is his fear, which is something saying that they're going to repeal the tax cuts. Well, that's not happening. I guess we know that. And that's the part I find puzzling about all of this. Jack Layton is talking in very vague terms about what he will or he won't support, yet we've got Tom Mulcair talking, I think, in far more precise terms about not just what he would or would not support, but what the caucus would support, suggesting that, you know, his opinion reflects caucus opinion.
Well, there must be some strategy.
Makes
going
me wonder.
I think there is.
He might be allowed to freelance that way because his principal opposition in his riding is the former Liberal MP there, Martin Cochon. The Liberals are taking a fairly strong stand on the tax cuts, so that's where Mulcair is vulnerable on that issue, perhaps in that riding. So he may be given a green light to freelance on that.
Yes. This is a huge game of chicken going on here, honestly.
I know, but listen, starting Monday, that's all we're going to do.
But this is, you know what? And that is a very interesting point, Rosie, because when you look, this thing is still 2 months away. You'd think there's only one thing happening in the next 3 months in the nation's capital and the seat of government is, will the budget pass or not?
But what if that is the only thing happening for the next couple of months? What if that is the only, I mean, obviously there's legislation that they'll return to when they come back, but in terms of the conversation around this town, don't you dread the thought that we may spend the next two months having this conversation?
Well, will there be anything else? I guess a human smuggling legislation will have to come eventually.
I predict there will be law and order legislation as well that will be coming
up. Safe.
No, I think.
Look, Greg's got a list.
Yeah, I know. I just.
Cleaning and positioning is what we're going to be seeing over the next 2 months.
There are, by my count, about 45 bills sitting in various stages right now. Some of them have been around for a number of years, moving very quickly nowhere.
Like a bad lunch, they keep coming back.
The official conservative line and where their focus will be, of course, on the economy leading up to the budget. There'll be lots of speeches about the economy, lots of those nice big checks being passed around around the country. They have several sentencing bills that are very close to the end of their process. They plan to try to get those passed by the time that there might be this so far mythical
showdown.
Election. Public Safety Committee has four pieces of legislation before it, and apparently they're going to turn up the heat on the committee to get those through. So,
there's
absolutely nothing new in there other than they will try to get those focused. So that the debate will all be around issues that tend to play to the conservative hand.
Okay, so then what happens in question period every day? Is it a continuing, because when they left, it was the Liberals on about the F-35s and the corporate taxes and spending. So is it just a continuation of developments of storylines leading up to this idea of an election?
I mean, don't you think that's what it has to be? You've got to sort of take that. I mean, you have to test run because you don't know what's going to happen when a budget comes down. And it's conveniently, we think, toward the end of March, which is perfect timing, as we all know, if you want a spring election, right? Mm-hmm. So it's later than what we would normally see a budget be. So you would have to use that time to sort of work on the narrative and somehow frame it around the issues that will naturally be coming before the House. And so, for us, I suppose it's an opportunity to see just how crystallized those messages are going to be on the campaign, should we actually see one.
I just wonder how sustainable they are.
I predict that we're going to see a wave of unanimity on the other parties wanting an election and absolute consensus on it being the other party's fault that an election comes along. That's what we're going to see. Right now, none of the numbers suggest that it's in anybody's advantage to have an election campaign. Unless that changes, I don't see why we would have an election. I can't see it yet.
Well, because there's a window. What about that idea, that there's a window because you get to the fall and you've got all those provincial elections and then you're going to have to wait till spring of 2012?
If you're Stephen Harper, though, and you can get your budget passed and be prime minister for another year unimpeded, because there are those fall campaigns, why wouldn't you take it?
Why do you let the Liberals get better? I'm not so sure about that because it gives them an opportunity to get better. I see the point you're making, but I don't think any of the pollsters would suggest that there's much opportunity for any of them to move in any great degree. Mm. Where you stand the best chance of moving and gaining some momentum is in a campaign. And amazing things can happen in campaigns in very short periods of time. And I think part of the calculation has to be, do we let the Liberals get better? Do we give them, because I agree about the timing, but if you don't do it in the spring, when do you do it? Spring of next year? And do you do it in spring
of next
year?
And how do you break the deadlock?
When you have
a
fixed election date in the fall of that, you know, it starts to get tricky.
But he's not Stéphane Dion. Ignatieff is not Stéphane Dion. So you start from that position that some of those seats that they lost because the Liberals stayed home last time, they're going to get back. They're going to get back unless Ignatieff implodes on the election campaign. So
do you allow him to get better, though?
I haven't seen the numbers move significantly, really, over 4 or 5 years. I think Canadians have the government they want. They're satisfied with the Conservatives having some power, but not unchecked power. They want to perhaps punish the Liberals and give them a little more time to get better, and they don't want to give the NDP the balance of power.
Get in there.
The one danger in all of this theory is that it assumes that public opinion will continue on this kind of flat line that it's been on for the last four years. There's an awful lot that can happen. Those provincial elections can change people's attitudes towards the government. And the thing that Stephen Harper has to fear the most is Canadians getting tired of the Conservative government. It'll be, 6 years going on next year. Is it time for a change? If the change card starts to play, that's going to be the Liberals' big advantage. The Liberals on their own, there's nothing in any polling that suggests there's suddenly going to be a great wave of Iggy mania out there. So without a big push to the Liberals, there has to be some sort of pushback away from the Conservatives. And given another year, given the volatile state of the economy, given all those myriad of things that can happen in 12 months of politics, I think the Prime Minister would like to take his chances this spring if he can.
To wrap it up.
Yeah.
So it's just a lame duck sitting of Parliament that I'm going back to on Monday.
Sure.
I've got nothing to look forward to.
doesn't it feel like that? I mean, when we talk about the legislative agenda, as we mentioned, it's what we've seen before, and they'll be before committee. Yeah. And I do think most people expect that this is test driving campaigns over the next couple of months in the House.
Well, I'll prepare for that all weekend. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it. Rob Russo, Kathleen Petty, and Greg Weston preparing us for a doozy of a sitting starting on Monday. Remember, you can get your political fix on the weekend, too, on CBC Radio. Kathleen Petty hosts The House that Saturday morning on CBC Radio 1, right after the 9 a.m. news, half an hour in Newfoundland. You don't want to miss it. Now, our question of the day. Earlier in the show, we heard from Neil Seaman, the U of T health researcher, who's suggesting the government give Canadians a $5,000 healthy living voucher to pay for healthier lifestyles. Today, we're asking you, should the government pay Canadians to get healthy, fit, and lose weight? Vote and contact us at cbc.ca/politics, politics@cbc.ca, and you can reach me on Twitter @RosieBarton. We'll read your best comments live on the air with Zuleka Nathu a little bit later in the program. Now, speaking of healthy lifestyles, columnist Mark Bittman has been promoting healthy, sustainable food in the New York Times. Now the minimalist columnist is getting hefty real estate in the paper's op-ed pages. How should North American food policy change? And has any country found the planet-friendly secret to growing and cooking food? We'll ask Mark Bittman next. No recipes, but it's still good.
So when I want to make something that really shows someone that I love them, I make short ribs.
Welcome back to P&P. Okay, I don't love short ribs, but for many years, Mark Bittman has been sharing his love for food and nutrition with his readers in the New York Times. In his column, The Minimalist, he established home cooking as the answer to sustainable agriculture and food cooking techniques for a hard-pressed planet. But now, his many fans will have to look for him on the Times op-ed page, where he'll be writing on food as an urgent subject of public policy. So where does food and cooking fit into government policy? Bittman's first op-ed will appear next week in the Times. And joining me now from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is Mark Bittman. Good to see you, Mark Bittman.
Hi, Rosemary. Great to be here.
So for our viewers who may not be familiar with your longtime column in the New York Times, The Minimalist, and the blog, can you just sort of give them what your principles are in terms of food and what you were sort of advocating for over those 13 years or so?
Well, longer than that, even. Yeah. My role has really been to try to help people get back into the kitchen and convince people that home cooking is easy and fun and rewarding and enjoyable and all of that. And as we all know, we've been through a very, very low period in the history of home cooking, which one hopes we're coming out of. But every week I tried to give people a recipe that was really fast, or at least really easy and uncomplicated, with few ingredients, no technique, that almost anyone could do. And you know, my background is that of a journalist, not a chef, and I became a home cook. And I thought I was in an unusual position to be able to use really journalistic skills to help people see what I saw, which is that, you know, cooking is easy.
So at what point did your sort of, it was a lifestyle column, really, is what you were writing, and now you're moving to the op-ed page, where I would say it's going to be much more perhaps politically focused. At what point did you make that sort of switch? At what point did you start becoming an advocate for certain ways of eating?
Well, you know, I would say that I always was an advocate for certain ways of eating. But that this is obviously going to be more verbally or more blatantly become more blatantly an advocate. Someone just reminded me that 20 years ago I wrote that vegetables and grains were the future of food, and that what may not have been prescient, but it was true then, and it's more obviously true now. And I think when you look at the typical American, which is also the typical Canadian mm-hmm. diet, you're looking at a diet that's bad for individuals and bad for the planet, bad for the environment, bad for animals, bad for just about everything. And in order to move into the future and move into a safer and healthier and more environmentally sound and more just way of eating, we have to make some changes. And that's a lot what the opinion column is going to be about.
What is one of your, I mean, I know you talk a lot about how the United States, and I guess Canada as well, has really focused too much on eating meat, and I know that you've sort of given it up at least during the day. What do you think is the most pressing concern in the United States in regards to food policy? Is it that? Is it the reliance on protein?
Well, I think it's the most pressing concern in terms of, you know, there's two questions here. What's wrong with the diet and what's wrong with the policy? Since you used the word policy, let's go there first. What's wrong with the policy is the subsidization of corn and soy and other commodity crops, which leads to a diet, which leads to the marketing, basically, of a diet, successful marketing of a diet that's very heavy in animals that are fed those crops and very heavy in processed foods that are made from those crops. And all of that stuff is, you know, is bad for us and is extremely stressful as far as the environment is concerned.
And what should the U.S. be changing? I mean, we know, of course, we've been hearing a lot in Canada as well about Michelle Obama's sort of switch and focus on young people to try and help childhood obesity. Does that make sense as the best place to start when it comes to eating habits?
Well, young people, of course, it's easiest to change people when they're young and quickly. I have a little anecdote that I was asked to try to help a family of five change the way they ate, and out of the five of them, the one who was by far the most responsive was a three-year-old girl. And she sort of understood much less of what I was talking about, but she said, okay, well, eat more fruit and vegetables, I'm fine with that. So there is sense in that, but I think that the policy issues are really, this is not a public relations effort, this is a little bit of an education effort. But when you have a nation that subsidizes, in effect, unhealthy, really bad food, it's making it more difficult to eat healthy, good food. So if we just shifted the subsidies, if we shifted the carrots and the sticks and made them completely opposite so that we were discouraging the eating of processed food and animal products and encouraging the eating of whole foods, grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, and so on, that's the kind of policy changes we need to see happening. And we're a long way from seeing that in the States.
A long way, but still, when you started the minimalist column, could you have imagined that one day you would have been offered a spot on the op-ed pages to talk about the politics around food, the environment, sustainability of food?
No, it's a dream come true. It's a terrific gig. At the same time, I take some credit. I give credit to the editorial board people at the Times, because when I went in and said, here's a great idea for you, they said, you're right, it is a great idea. Mm-hmm. So I think it's clear that food has an impact on everything in the world. Food is, you know, of paramount importance in economics and global trade and international relations and in our daily lives. And so there's a, you know, if you can have opinion columns about international trade, opinion columns about politics, about economics, and so on, food deserves a place in there. The fact that I'm the person who's going to get to write it is a personal thrill, but I would argue that someone needs to be writing this.
And there has been an evolution in awareness of this, and so I can see how you're going to have lots of readers there. I mean, people talk more about the local food movement. People are buying organic. But, you know, it's just, it's more out there. Wouldn't you agree that that has evolved?
It's, you know, it's funny because food has never... Food has always been at the center of every single person's life.
Yeah.
And yet it seems to us that suddenly it's more core, it's more, there's more conversation focused on it. Whether that's true or not, I don't really know, but what is true is that we are in North America and globally, we're in trouble in terms of our food supply, in terms of the way we eat, in terms of the way we raise food. And to talk about this on a daily basis makes complete sense.
But we should tell people, you're not a food snob. You're not someone that, you know, thinks that you have to do complicated recipes or that you always have to buy the organic broccoli. You're not that guy.
No, I'm not. And if I were, I would have been better.
Need to break into that interview to bring you breaking news. Here's U.S. President Barack Obama from the White House commenting for the first time today on the developments in Egypt.
As the situation continues to unfold, our first concern is preventing injury or loss of life. So I want to be very clear in calling upon the Egyptian authorities to refrain from any violence against peaceful protesters. The people of Egypt have rights that are universal. That includes the right to peaceful assembly and association, the right to free speech, and the ability to determine their own destiny. These are human rights, and the United States will stand up for them everywhere. I also call upon the Egyptian government to reverse the actions that they've taken to interfere with access to the Internet, to cell phone service, and to social networks that do so much to connect people in the 21st century. At the same time, those protesting in the streets have a responsibility to express themselves peacefully. Violence and destruction will not lead to the reforms that they seek. Now, going forward, this moment of volatility has to be turned into a moment of promise. The United States has a close partnership with Egypt, and we've cooperated on many issues, including working together to advance a more peaceful region. But we've also been clear that there must be reform, political, social, and economic reforms that meet the aspirations of the Egyptian people. In the absence of these reforms, grievances have built up over time. When President Mubarak addressed the Egyptian people tonight, he pledged a better democracy and greater economic opportunity. I just spoke to him after his speech. And I told him he has a responsibility to give meaning to those words, to take concrete steps and actions that deliver on that promise. Violence will not address the grievances of the Egyptian people, and suppressing ideas never succeeds in making them go away. What's needed right now are concrete steps that advance the rights of the Egyptian people, a meaningful dialogue between the government and its citizens, and a path of political change that leads to a future of greater freedom and greater opportunity and justice for the Egyptian people. Now, ultimately, the future of Egypt will be determined by the Egyptian people. And I believe that the Egyptian people want the same things that we all want, a better life for ourselves and our children, and a government that is fair and just and responsive. And put simply, the Egyptian people want a future that befits the heirs to a great and ancient civilization. The United States always will be a partner in pursuit of that future, and we are committed to working with the Egyptian government and the Egyptian people, all quarters, to achieve it. Around the world, governments have an obligation to respond to their citizens. That's true here in the United States. That's true in Asia. It is true in Europe. It is true in Africa. And it's certainly true in the Arab world, where a new generation of citizens has the right to be heard. When I was in Cairo, shortly after I was elected president, I said that all governments must maintain power through consent, not coercion. That is the single standard by which the people of Egypt will achieve the future they deserve. Surely there will be difficult days to come, but the United States will continue to stand up for the rights of the Egyptian people and work with their government in pursuit of a future that is more just, more free, and more hopeful. Thank you very much.
We're just listening to President Barack Obama speaking live from the White House, speaking for the first time publicly since some of those riots and chaos have erupted in the streets of Cairo in Egypt. As you know, the United States and Egypt have a very close relationship. Egypt is really an ally for the U.S. in that part of the world. Barack Obama spoke to President Hosni Mubarak for about 30 minutes just after the live speech that we took earlier. He asked Mubarak to take steps to address the grievances of the citizens demonstrating in Egypt. He asked for protesters to protest peacefully and asked for them to be treated properly as well. He asked for reform to continue in Egypt, and he reminded those in Egypt and around the world that they must maintain power through consent and not coercion. He said that there are difficult days to come, but that the United States plans to continue working with Egypt to try and maintain calm there. So those are the first words that we've heard from President Barack Obama on the developing situation out of Egypt. We have also just received a comment from our government, from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Lawrence Cannon. The statement says that the government urges Egypt to move quickly on democratic change and respond peacefully to the protests. The statement also says, here you can see part of it, we continue to call for the full respect of freedom of expression in Egypt. Democratic development is a priority of Canadian foreign policy. Democratic development advances Canada's interests because it offers the best chance for long-term stability, prosperity, and the protection of human rights. So both Canada and the United States walking a very delicate diplomatic line to try and keep Egypt as an ally in that critical part of the world, but also to make sure that democracy and people's voices are heard and that human rights are respected. Well, coming up, our political insiders will go ahead, head-to-head on those controversial Conservative Party ads. Has the party gone too far with its latest ads? How far is too far? Jamie Watt and Scott Reed are here for Point of Order. That's next on Power and Politics. We'll have all the developments on Egypt, too, as they are coming. So stay with us.
Tonight, as the protests and tensions heighten in Egypt, CBC News is on the front lines of the story. The world watches this landmark anti-government rally erupt. Tonight on The National.
Welcome back to Power and Politics. Time now to check in with Zuleika Nathu. She's, of course, following all these developments as they unfold in Egypt, unfolding very quickly. But Zuleika, you've got some other news as well. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Rosemary, two Canadians are among the injured after a deadly suicide attack in Afghanistan. At least eight people are dead after an explosion at a supermarket popular with foreigners in Kabul. A lone attacker walked into a store and opened fire before detonating his explosives. Afghan police say foreigners are among the dead. No Canadian casualties have been reported. The attack took place in an area close to many foreign embassies. The Taliban is claiming responsibility, saying the target was a U.S.-based security contractor. This is the deadliest incident involving foreign civilians in over a year. Nelson Mandela is back at home tonight after spending 2 days in hospital in South Africa. Speculation over the former president's health ran rampant after news spread he would spend a second night in hospital. Mandela was being treated for an acute respiratory infection. Doctors say the 92-year-old is in stable condition and is in good spirits. He will continue to receive treatment at home. Well-wishers brought flowers today and their hopes for a speedy recovery. Rosemary,
it's amazing at his age and everything that he's seen that he can actually still sort of stick it out with his health. So I can see why there's so many people that are going there day after day to try to wish him well.
No kidding. That's a story everyone's going to watch. Before I let you go, what's your name on Twitter, Zuleka?
It's Zuleka_CBC.
Okay, I'm going to add you. Everyone should follow you. Thanks very much, Zuleka. Appreciate it.
There you go. You're welcome.
Welcome back to Power and Politics. Well, the countdown is on. 2 days left until MPs migrate back to Ottawa. So who better than to call in than our top political insiders for Point of Order, Jamie Watt and Scott Reed. But before we get there, let's start off with the big global story of the day. The Arab world on edge right now. Today, the Egyptian government turned off cell phones and internet service as anti-government protests boiled over and similar unrest is ongoing in Tunisia and Yemen. So let's start with Jamie. What do you think all this means for Prime Minister Harper and for the government's foreign policy?
Well, Rosie, what we're seeing on television today is absolutely unprecedented, really uncertain time in that part of the world. Your question is, Rosie's question was about what should Prime Minister Harper do, and I think what he should do is not hedge his bets. And I think Canada should act as a nation. I think it's time for us to side clearly with those who believe in democracy and who believe in human rights. You know, turning off the internet, Scott, I don't even know how you do that, but
the
we should be for it.
Big button.
Well, they shouldn't be pushing
all
that button.
When I was in the Prime Minister's office, we had
you
the internet button.
You would have loved button. To have pushed
we had the internet button.
Button.
I never pushed it, but you know, it was right there.
It, and we shouldn't be for anybody that's
no,
pushing
that's right.
One thing that I think is very clear is that folks over there are passionately committed to change, and this is going to go on for a while, so we better get on the right side of it.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. First, before we even get to that in terms of the foreign policy and managing the interests out there, I think we need to start with managing our own people and our own nationals and making certain that they're safe and well afforded for. So as an example, we have tons of people in Egypt. We need to make certain as this situation deteriorates on the streets that they can get in and out fast because we all have seen what happens. Second, whatever happens in the next few weeks, there's going to be an exodus from that country.
Right.
And we're going to have to prepare our system now to manage that. And we should be thinking now rather than scrambling at the last second. But finally, in terms of the strategic interest and in terms of foreign policy and the position we should take, I'm inclined to agree with you. I think that we ought to be on the side of those that are demanding change. It's been 30 years of an authoritarian regime. But we also have to be responsible. What is going to come next? Are we going to see... Are we going to see the unfortunate stability of a nasty authoritarian regime replaced with the instability and the craziness of what? That we have to think about, and we have to think about it from a regional perspective, not just that one single nation.
On that, we both agree, Russ.
Okay, fellas, next topic. The Conservatives released another ad yesterday and again targeted Liberal leader Michael Ignatieff. This time, they used Ignatieff's own words against him. Well, not quite, but let's look at the ad and the context, and then we'll get your take.
At a time of economic uncertainty, does it make sense to jeopardize our recovery with an unnecessary election? Let's ask Michael Ignatieff.
Yes! Yes! Yes!
Ignatieff, he didn't come back for you.
Are we ready to fight for the Canadian family? What's the answer to that? Yes! 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 Way!
Okay, Scott.
Howard Dean, Scott.
I'm guessing, I'm guessing Scott Reed's got an opinion. Is this too far?
Yes, it is too far, and I think it's really important to say so and to call it out because, you know, you and I have both been involved in running campaigns. We've both been involved in helping to put together ads and to approving ads that go on television, and some of them have been tough and hard-hitting. When you cross the line, it's important to say so. There is a tyranny taking place right now in the discussion around this discussion, and it's a tyranny of false moral equivalency. This is not just another ad that's like others. It wasn't misleading. It was manufactured. And if you're going to say it's okay to tell people not what's true, but things that are literally made up, you're going to take his answer to one question and substitute it in answer to another, it's wrong. Tom Flanagan wrote about the Harper Conservatives that they felt no obligation to speak the truth, that they were happy if it was plausible. This is wrong. It should be called out for,
Scott,
and the media should do so as well.
Looks like a duck, walks like a duck, talks like a quack, quack, quack. It's a duck. He said he's going to vote against the budget. He's voting against corporate
tax. About the ad.
He's got his own ads.
It's manufactured.
He's got his bus tour.
Take him on policy and what he says.
You want to see ads that are manufactured? Remember this one? Here's an ad that you guys made. You can say that it didn't run very often.
It
was only up for a little time. You made the ad, Scott, and it took a
policy position.
A policy position.
You're right. It was complete BS.
No, it wasn't. First
no,
of all,
I'm
it was based
sorry.
On policy.
This is complete moral equivalency
it.
Of these
We
threats.
Had the integrity in the
You
board
made it.
We had the integrity to
you
say, you know what?
We need that bell. We need that bell. They made that ad and put it on the internet.
We demonstrated integrity when Stephen Harper has demonstrated a total and utter lack of it.
I'm glad you guys like each other off the set, because that was fired up. Okay, here's something else that's fired up. Election speculation, and MPs aren't even back yet, but they do get back on Monday. So let's go through what each leader or some of the leaders need to achieve this week. Jamie Watt, start us off.
Okay, just very quickly on the four leaders. Prime Minister Harper just has to keep doing what he's doing. I think the ballot question's getting set nicely for him, which is it's the economy, stupid, and as long as that's the ballot question, that's to his advantage. We'll see how it works out.
That's think
advantage.
So.
Stay
we'll
the course with Prime Minister Harper. I think Mr. Ignatieff, he's got to buy a clue. I think he's just got to figure out where he's going and what he's doing.
Well,
buy a vowel, buy a clue, buy something, because his plan to fight on corporate tax cuts isn't going to cut it. Jack Layton, speaking of game shows, Jack Layton has got to trade away door number one, door number two, door number three, anything to get that budget passed and save his political skin. And Mr. Duceppe, I think it's simple. Light a candle, say a prayer, cross his fingers, make sure he doesn't lose political subsidies.
All right. Here's my take. Mr. Harper, the prime minister of the country, the man who lacks integrity in the things that he says to the public and that he advertises about his opponents.
What
he
ad hominem attack.
What he, ad hominem and actually based completely in reality. He actually has to spend next week beginning to precondition that the parliament is dysfunctional. We've seen him do it before, but that's going to be the precondition for him to change his tune and say, you know what, I am in favor of a campaign, because he is and he's going to want one. Ignatieff, he needs to do something that the Liberals haven't done in the past, and I think he is prepared to do it now, and that's not chase the ambulance every morning. Focus in question period on a consistent message. Fighter jets and corporate tax cuts are wrong priorities for Canadians. I think you're going to hear a lot of that. And, you know, I'll just stop at Layton, because, frankly, I think what he needs to do is the most interesting and the most challenging. First, he's got to put a net over Thomas McClair, get him off stage when McClair starts talking tough, because Jack Layton's job is to strike a deal, and he's going to have to kiss a lot of Tory rear end in the next week.
Okay, last topic, the one I dread the most, but we talk about the most in spite of ourselves. Will there be a spring election? Scott Reed, weigh in.
May we, Rosie? There is going to be an election, and there's going to be an election for one reason and one reason only. Stephen Harper wants one. He's gone through the pretense of saying he doesn't want one, but we know he does. We know he does for a number of reasons. As you know, he likes to say about people, don't pay attention to what they say, pay attention to what they do. What has he been doing? Spending millions of dollars on advertisements to precondition for the election and to hammer his opponents, even in a way that completely, as I've mentioned, lacks integrity and honesty. And secondly, what he's been doing, right? He's been telling Jack Layton no. Layton couldn't be more obvious. If he showed up in a top hat with flowers and chocolate, right? I come a courting, Mr. Harper.
Champagne too.
Right? And Harper wouldn't even meet with him over the budget. It is obvious that he wants to have an election, so that's why we're going to have an election, because in this parliament, he only needs to strike a deal with one party, and that's not impossible.
I think, actually, there's going to be a bunch of parties that are going to want an election this year, because I think three things are happening behind the scenes which are militating towards an election. The first one is the discount on the party that triggers an election has been pretty much removed. Even if Canadians are not enthusiastic about an election, we're not where we were a year ago. Secondly, nothing's happening outside of an election environment. And I believe campaigns matter, and I know you believe campaigns matter. And I think at some point people are going to say, you know what, let's mix it up and see what happens.
You're going to snap your fingers and everything changes? People are going to like what they don't like?
The third reason is because there's all these things are always driven in part by the human dimension. And one of the human dimensions we have here is a lot of people in Ottawa who've been living 6 months at a time. And no, that's not a reason there should be an election, but that's one of the reasons elections do get called. They haven't unpacked their boxes, they haven't moved their kids and their family, and they just want some certainty in their lives.
Oh, that's
right. And
we're going to have an election because Harper thinks he can win.
We can't plan our vacations because we don't know what the heck is going on. That's
you want to have a holiday.
That's
sandals, here you come.
And that's the end of Point of Order for another week. Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Jamie.
We'll see you later.
See you next week.
Tonight on Connect, continuing coverage of Egypt on the Edge. We'll have the latest developments on the ground, reaction from around the world.
We support the universal human rights of the Egyptian people.
From Egyptians in Canada, and a closer look at the main players as we watch history being made in the Middle East. It all starts tonight at 8 Eastern on CBC News Network.
Welcome back to Power and Politics. Just moments ago, U.S. President Barack Obama made a statement on the political unrest happening in Egypt, calling on the Egyptian government to take steps to address the grievances of its citizens. We want to show you a little bit of what Obama had to say just moments ago.
I want to be very clear in calling upon the Egyptian authorities to refrain from any violence against peaceful protesters. The people of Egypt have rights that are universal. That includes the right to peaceful assembly and association, the right to free speech, and the ability to determine their own destiny. These are human rights, and the United States will stand up for them everywhere. I also call upon the Egyptian government to reverse the actions that they've taken to interfere with access to the internet, to cell phone service, and to social networks that do so much to connect people in the 21st century. At the same time, those protesting in the streets have a responsibility to express themselves peacefully.
That was, again, the first statements from the president, Barack Obama, in response to the chaos on the streets in Egypt. President Barack Obama saying that he spoke to the president of Egypt, President Mubarak, earlier this evening after Mubarak made his first statements to his citizens. Okay, so now back to our question of the day. Earlier we asked you, remember that, should the government pay Canadians to get healthy, to get fit, to lose weight? Just wanted to give you one more of the responses that we had. You can see the results already, but listen to this response. Yes, if Canadians are paid to get healthy, Canada's health care costs will be reduced, our productivity will increase, we'll all be happier, live longer, and many types of crime will be reduced. That's from Bill McKinnon, the Eastern Passage of Nova Scotia. Thanks for that, Bill. So Bill, like others, weighed in, and here's what you thought. Should the government pay Canadians to get healthy? 21% of you said yes, 76% of you said no, get healthy on your own, and 3% of you weren't sure about that one. Thanks for weighing in. Well, if you hadn't noticed, it gets pretty chaotic up here on Parliament Hill, and it will again starting on Monday. But nothing will match what NDP leader Jack Layton sees as he works in the emergency room of a busy Hamilton, Ontario hospital. Take a look at this.
On Make the Politician Work, we've lifted NDP leader Jack Layton from the front benches of the House of Commons.
Stop the privatization of our healthcare system.
And dropped him into the front lines of the Canadian healthcare system.
Well, I hope I don't screw up.
He'll spend 2 days working hands-on in a hospital.
Don't move your hands there, Jack.
If he thought politics was a pressure cooker, just wait till he does a shift in a real emergency department.
All right, relax. Let's go quickly.
Can Jack Layton survive in healthcare's toughest proving ground?
I'm just wondering, is it going to work?
Or is he about to flatline?
Remember, you can catch Make the Politician Work this Sunday. It's on CBC television at 10:30 p.m., half an hour later in Newfoundland, and on CBC News Network at 9:30 p.m. Eastern. I'm laughing because I'm wondering if he really did that stuff, because I sure wouldn't do it. On Monday, MPs head back to Parliament Hill, and Power and Politics, of course, will be there. We'll have special coverage live from the foyer of the House of Commons. We'll talk to all the parties about their priorities for this new sitting. We'll talk to them about the chances for an election, about what might be in the budget, what they want to see there. All three leaders of the opposition will be there. Michael Ignatieff, Jack Layton, and Gilles Duceppe will join Evan, of course, Evan Solomon, too. He'll be back on Monday to talk more about the budget, the possible spring election, and the priorities as they return. Find out all of that on Monday. That's right here on Power and Politics, of course, at 5 Eastern, as usual. That's Power and Politics for now. I'm Rosemary Barton. We'll see you back here on Monday with the return of all those politicians. Stay right here for the Lang and O'Leary Exchange.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.